Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. Heather Canavan is a professor in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering. Over the years, she made a practice of giving students extra credit when they applied their knowledge to solving real-world problems. That background, combined with her own experience going through breast cancer treatment, inspired her to start the Adaptive Biomedical Design Company last year with PhD student Phong Nguyen. Heather Canavan, thank you for joining me on University Showcase. What was the idea behind the company?
We wanted to work on improving the patient experience for people who are suffering from either short or long-term disabilities. The idea being that for people who've had serious illnesses, whether it's cancer or anything else, there's a lot of interest focused on the detection of the disease, the immediate treatment of the disease, but there's not a lot of research that goes into the aftermath of what you have afterwards. And I had been thinking about that quite a bit, not just from my own experiences, but from listening to other people and hearing about some really serious consequences that they were living with and saying, you know, I wish that someone would work on improving my ability to take a shower after I've had surgery or improving my ability to deal with colitis or something that was sort of a long-term symptom that they were left with. And I kept thinking, you know, someone should really work on that. That's a really big problem. And then I started thinking, wait a minute, I have a PhD, I'm a biomedical engineer, I should work on that. And so that's when we formed the company and started writing proposals to do this type of research. And it all blew up from there.
It all blew up from there. Talk about the evolution of the idea. I know you used to, in your classes, you had the practice
of
having your students do this.
The idea for having students do design challenges in classes is that usually we're teaching fairly theoretical types of subject matter that hasn't changed a great deal. But the idea is that that doesn't always work well for some of the population that's studying engineering. And most recently in engineering education, people have seen that you have better retention rates for students, better graduation rates, and better interest from students from minorities and women if you have something that really ties it back to the community, like a design challenge. So I started doing design challenges along with the majority of my department, the Chemical and Biological Engineering Department, over the past couple of years. And so I teach a class in biomaterials, I teach another class in global health, and I started introducing this idea of while you're studying the subject matter and taking exams and quizzes and doing homework and so forth, I'm also going to put you into a team and see how you can apply that knowledge directly. And I saw that there was a lot of interest, there's been a lot of excitement, and I just saw that this was a way for students to really get dug into the subject that they were studying and really understand it on a new level. And I thought, this is also something that I've had lots of students in my group. I think I've had 45 or 50 students by this point, PhDs, masters, high school students, undergrads. And what I started seeing was they're all going off to these great careers, but they have a lot of theoretical knowledge, but not necessarily a lot of experience with what does it take to actually bring something to market? What does it take to write a patent? And I didn't know that either. I'd never, ever thought of patenting anything until June. And so I thought, well, this would be a great experience for all of those students who are kind of non-traditional, not necessarily interested in becoming the next professor, but want to do something really great with their careers. And I thought this would be a great way to do it.
Your facility or your offices are based in the Lobo Rainforest building?
The Lobo Rainforest is the home of the NSF I-Corps site program. And
so that's the National Science Foundation?
Right.
What is that designed to do?
It's the same idea of if you have a student who's really interested about a project, pairing them with a professor and then a mentor to learn about market research and customer discovery and so forth, give them a 7-week training in this area and then see how far they can go. And they had just launched this when we had just started the company. And so three of my students applied for the I-Corps program, and all three of them got in. And actually, we have two of the students who did those projects here today with us.
Ty Martin, you are one of the inventors, one of the students.
Yes, I am.
Tell me about the invention that you were working on, the shower chaise.
Yes. So I met with Professor Canavan over this last summer, right when they were starting to get the company launched. And we started talking about some of the issues with some of the devices, and then the shower chair situation kind of came up, and I've had quite a bit of experience, you know, with that being a motorized wheelchair user. So I kind of described some of the issues I'd face, and she had some from post-surgery, you know, recovery. And so we started talking about this idea, and like, you know, there's not a good shower situation for anyone with, you know, short or long-term mobility limitations. So
I know having an elderly mom, there are things out there. Why are they insufficient? What problem are you looking to solve?
Right. So for the most part, they're very rigid designs. And one of the major problems I found out that is that insurance doesn't really offer any type of financial support for these devices. So in most cases, people are trying to get loaner equipment and things like that. And, you know, there's really just no customization with the designs that are currently available. Our design is more of a modular type of chair to fit individual needs more. So we basically have different packages with different items to include, such as a footrest, for example, or maybe offering like a reclining type of mechanism, you know, to lean back for certain people. So
where are you in the development?
We filed a provisional patent last semester, and now we're trying to look at initial prototyping to come up with a initial design. And then we're doing some 3D printing also to sort of initialize the process for building it.
So. Is your hope to do this in a way so it's affordable if insurance won't cover it?
That is the hope, yes. We're definitely trying to, you know, find the most feasible way to design it for people.
Your question about saying, you know, having an elderly mom, I have an experience with this. That's exactly where all of this came from. Mm-hmm. Was I was telling Ty, you know, I had this experience. I needed to wash my hair because I felt disgusting after, you know, 2 weeks of not being able to take a shower. Mm-hmm. It's hard to lean back enough to be able to wash your hair and not get your sutures and so forth wet. You know, this is my experience. I'm coming from a short-term disability experience. And then I'm talking to Ty, who's had a lot of experience over the past 20 years of different types of designs. And I talked with Fong, who's the co-founder, and her grandfather had a stroke, I believe. And so they had another level of care that they needed. And so the idea was, well, could we make something that's very comfortable for people who need to be in the shower for a much longer period of time and make it more modular so that people can customize it towards what their need is.
And Ty, what was it like to be able to work on a project like this?
So my research is a little bit more non-traditional for engineering as well. I'm doing a lot of computer simulations with Alzheimer's related proteins. And so it's quite a change in direction for me to work on this type of project. And I'd thought about it in the past, you know, wouldn't it be nice to try to design some of the things that would help me on a day-to-day basis, you know, and so that's kind of a really nice thing about this project. It allows me to do something that, you know, helps me as well as hopefully other people.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm talking with Professor Heather Canavan about the company she launched last year called Adaptive Biomedical Design. We just heard from one of her student inventors, Ty Martin. Her co-founder in the company, Fong Nguyen, says the idea for another invention came during a meeting the two had after Canavan had a colonoscopy.
I brought her sandwiches and boba tea from my sister's shop, Sweet Tea Bakery. If you don't know what boba tea is, it's like the little tapioca pearls. They're kind of chewy. Anyway, she had some, and she was like, you know what we can do? I had this really terrible colonoscopy prep experience, and it was just the worst. And I think we can encapsulate into balls, like these tapioca balls, and like drink colonoscopy prep that way. And so that's how we came up with Bubblite, our colonoscopy prep product, and really started the company.
Yeah. It was this idea of, you know, I'd gone through a million different procedures and multiple surgeries and so forth, and they were all fine. The doctors were great. The nurses were fantastic. But the prep for that GI imaging series was just the worst. And I was like,
well, what? Almost everyone would say that,
yeah.
I think, who's
yeah.
had to do that.
It's the worst. And I thought, if I never have to do this again, it will be too soon. And it's because of the viscous feeling. And for me, it wasn't even the taste. It was the viscosity just made me gag. And I thought, we need to come up with a different way of making this more palatable to patients, because what ends up happening is that people, once they've had that experience, are less likely to schedule at the correct time, which then puts them at a higher risk for colorectal cancer, which is an extremely treatable and preventable disease. It's 85% preventable if you actually go in on the right schedule. And if people fall behind, they're at a higher risk of this cancer. And so when Fong brought in the bubble tea, it was this light bulb moment where I thought we could do this, and then no one has to taste it. They can swallow them, they can chew them. And this was the first invention that really I thought, this is what I want to do.
So I could actually have a boba tea instead of drinking that nasty stuff.
And so that was the idea. The idea is you can have similar to a boba tea and possibly reduce the amount of water or whatever you have to drink with it. And furthermore, because of the way the dosage is, if you notice, everybody, regardless of size, gets this like giant 1 gallon jug. Right. And so, and it's because it, to doctors, it doesn't really matter, because really you just want to empty the person out. But for the patient, you know, you really only want to take it to the point that you empty out, and not necessarily, you know, a 6'5" tall white male versus me, 5'1" little Asian.
Right. So we're hoping that that will be the first one that, that really moves forward.
Where are you?
Intended.
I was going to go there, but then you went there first. What, so where are you with that whole process?
So it's actually now my PhD dissertation. So we're working on the project. We've developed, designed some of the gels. I kind of need to perfect it a little bit to make sure that it works as intended, but so far it seems to be working out pretty well.
So they're basically at the point where they're doing all of the preliminary studies that you need to get through the first phase of FDA approval. And I say they because Fong is the graduate student who's working on this, but we also have an undergraduate student, Darnell Kyler, and also a high school student working on this as well.
We have another inventor here, mm-hmm. Wendy Sims Small. And you're a nurse.
I am.
At UNMHSC.
That's true. I've been a nurse at UNMH for about 15 years. And I've had the pleasure of working with Dr. Canavan and her students.
And how did you get involved in this?
My involvement in ABD has been just a little bit of consulting. But I also have brought a project to the group. It's called the Be Positive. It's an error reduction blood collection system that has to do with the order of blood draws.
So what's the problem you're trying to solve?
You may have noticed that when you get have blood work done, that your phlebotomist or nurse will collect the specimens in vials that have different color stoppers at the top. The color of the stopper is associated with a preservative that's on the inside of the vial. We need to stay away from mixing those preservatives in a way that affects the results of the lab work. Some of the blood that we might collect would be for anticoagulation, and some might be about electrolytes. When we draw those labs in an order that is different from what is recommended by national guidelines, we can affect the lab work, which affects patient outcomes. So my idea is a device that will prevent that from happening.
So draw a picture for me when you're a nurse doing that, since we might not pay attention when we're getting a needle in our arm.
The first thing is that drawing blood from a patient is always a little bit, it produces a little bit of anxiety for the patient, but also for the phlebotomist or the nurse, because you want to be successful, and we know it's painful for patients. Currently in practice, we have a mnemonic that is supposed to help us remember, this is called the order of the draw, but frequently it's the case that it's difficult to recall that mnemonic in
what
a moment
mean?
Of tension.
Okay, tell me, explain what that is.
So the mnemonic device reflects the color of the vial in a way that's supposed to help our recall.
This is like the rainbow RG Biv thing?
Yeah. Kind of like that, yes.
But it's really complicated.
Yeah, okay. Some of them are really complicated. I looked one up and it was like, you better not get downright lazy love or you will get something. Like, I can't even remember it.
And it's different for each kind of blood draw.
Exactly. And it's different for each blood draw and it's different for each hospital. And when she mentioned this to me, it automatically referred. I scribed in the emergency department at one point, and you know, things are, like, sometimes really crazy in the emergency department. You know, these phlebotomists or techs who are poking the patient who's lying there has to remember the order of draw while, like, everyone is around and working on them all at the same time with, like, three ambulance guys, a doctor, two doctors, three nurses. Everybody's pulling into the room, and you can, like, imagine how this gets really hard to remember that, you know, U stands for yellow and better stands for blue. And,
and which blue? Because there's which a light blue and a royal blue.
And I'm just sitting there like, wow, this is insane. Like,
you want to make sure that the nurses aren't preoccupied with this mnemonic and trying to remember which order. And they're not worried about that. They can focus on their actual job. And so we thought, well, we'll just make a physical container for them that reminds them of the order of the draw and forces them to do it in the correct way so they don't have to worry about it. It's one less thing to worry about. It's not necessarily something that a patient would notice, but something that's coming from the healthcare industry, from people who are the boots on the ground or the clogs on the ground in the case of nurses, saying this is something that I know is a concern for us. We want to do a good job. We want to prevent this kind of error. We want to make sure that we're not wasting these supplies, we're not doing unnecessary draws, it's expensive, it can cause harm. We want to prevent that. How can you help us? And I thought, this is a perfect project. This is a perfect 3D printing problem. This is a, you know, a 10-cent solution that we've been working on.
What does it look like?
So right now we have multiple variations of it.
Right.
It's like almost like test tube rags, but with different colors on top in a specific direction. So you look at it and you know exactly, okay, this is the color I started, this is next.
But this is the kind of project that I really was hoping for students, mm-hmm. because it is solving a problem, coming to the customer, in this case Wendy, and saying, what do you think about this design? Mm-hmm. And having Wendy say, well, actually, we want to make sure that it's something that we can easily store in the hospital, so you need to make it this kind of dimension instead of this kind of dimension. Go back to the drawing board, try it again, you know, and problem solve through it. So it's a perfect engineering design problem for both Fong and our undergraduate Darnell to work on, to learn how to do that kind of research that's customer focused, but it's really solving a problem. So that's really what I wanted to do.
And so you're nodding, Wendy. You seem pretty excited about it.
I am excited. I think Fong and also Darnell have made tremendous progress, and hopefully we're addressing a problem that will make things easier for healthcare professionals and, most importantly, best care for our patients.
Right.
And the cool thing is I have this resource, which is the university with a 3D printer, for me to try and print these, because it sounds really long, like each of these prints takes 6 hours, but they're really cheap, they're really easy to do, really easy to modify.
Yeah, it's really revolutionized.
And it's almost like revolutionary, because if mm-hmm. you think about it, I can print these in 6 hours to make just sample prototypes that I can keep making new ones until I get a better prototype that I can then get an injection mold and plastic prints thousands or whatever we need of these.
And the difference in from what is there now is that it's like color coded in a way that they don't have to.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
They actually don't even have anything to hold them.
They don't have
what
you have right now. What you have right now is the nurse who's
holding it in the hands.
Holding it in their hands, kind
or
of like
maybe a patient holding them.
Yeah.
Or
and
on
their legs.
This is a challenge. Yeah.
That's crazy.
It is.
Tubes roll about.
And
they get lost in the sheets. In an emergency situation, you can easily lose track of a tube.
It's shocking.
That you
no
needed
one has
to
done
use.
This before.
I agree.
And then
the majority of the projects that we started with, I would be describing them, and people would say, that is crazy that doesn't already exist. And I would say, I know. Mm-hmm. It is a stupid problem, and I am happy to solve it. We've been focused on very specific aspects of healthcare. And we've really neglected the people who have the experience, who are seeing the problems all the time and not tapping their creativity. And that's people like Wendy, people who are nurses, people who are phlebotomists, who are thinking, this would make my job so much easier. And so I really want to partner with those people and say, what is the idea that you've got? What is the idea that you'd really like to see go forward? How can we make that happen? And so we submitted a preliminary patent. Wendy's the first author on the patent because mm-hmm. this is her idea. She's been with us every step of the way. You know, I really want to make this happen for her. to see Wendy become an inventor and really see her vision come true.
If you just tuned in, this is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking with the founders and inventors at Adaptive Biomedical Design, which launched last year. Director Professor Heather Canavan says having a diverse design team has been key to their success.
When you look at big failures in designs, it's usually because they didn't have a great diversity of thought. So the example I always use with my students is that of when airbags were first developed. And they were developed for the typical American, which is a 6'1" man who weighs 180 pounds. Initially, we had problems with people who are very short, people who are pregnant, children, and so forth, having a lot of serious injuries due to the design of airbags. And so if we'd only had women, people who are pregnant, and so forth, we wouldn't necessarily have gone down that same route. So the idea here is I've got a very diverse team. We've got students who have disabilities. We have people who are more than half the group is women. We've got people from Vietnam, people who are African American, Hispanic, from all different walks that are coming together to talk about what's important for the different designs.
So how does this work in terms of the structure of UNM?
So UNM is getting a share right off the top, which I am very happy for them to get because that's where all the lawyers are paid. And we don't have to do all of the research and file, you know, against the counterclaims and so forth. I am very happy to avoid that type of paperwork. But then we'll be the first in line to, in order to license everything when we're hopefully successful with our patents.
What does doing this kind of work mean for you all in terms of where you want to go?
You know, I always thought I would end up going into academia after I graduated. And working with this project, it's opened up sort of the, you know, the side that I could go into maybe some industry type of thing or just continue with the company, you know, and just develop new products over time. And it's been a really nice thing, you know, that I hadn't thought about as an option for me before. And it's kind of opened that door.
What about you, Fong?
For the longest time, I've always kind of looked into going into industry. The company really, for me, has just been a lot of fun and just kind of exploring the options that I have and the things that I was interested in and just kind of seeing it come to life.
Wendy, are there other things you're thinking they could take on? Are there problems?
Well, I don't think it'll be too long before something else arises. There'll be more ideas that sort of bubble up. Mm-hmm. And that I think there'll be more evolution of this.
Heather, what's your hope for growing this effort?
Well, when I started this company, I had a number of goals in mind. The first one was I really wanted to see some of these issues that I had identified be solved or get some research, some interest. And we've been doing that, and I'm very excited about that. I also wanted to give new pathways to my students after they graduate, and that's happening as well. Nothing would make me happier than to see a whole bunch of little entrepreneurs graduate and go off and create companies that bring jobs and success to New Mexico. I think that would be fantastic. And the third big one was that I wanted for people who had been patients and sort of passive in their experience with cancer or any other illness, I wanted them to be able to see themselves as experts and as creators and inventors and problem solvers. And that is what kept me sane when I was going through all of my treatments, and it made me feel like I had something still to contribute, and I want that to be the experience that everyone else has as well.
Great. Well, thank you all for coming and talking about this. Very interesting.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That was Professor Heather Canavan with her co-founder at Adaptive Biomedical Design, Fong Nguyen, as well as student inventor Ty Martin and Wendy Sims Small with the UNM Health Sciences Center. Now we go to a new segment on University Showcase that highlights research at UNM by students and professors.
Nobody's ever gonna read this!
This is Marty Adam Smith, in studio with PhD student in anthropology at the University of New Mexico, Marty Pfeiffer. How are you doing today, Marty?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. What do you research?
I look at how we create and socially circulate beliefs and values about nuclear weapons, with an especial focus on heritage sites like museums and the nuclear weapon laboratories.
Very cool. And so what's on your mind with regard to nuclear weapons over the last 12 months of the Trump administration?
Dear God, we're all going to die. A little bit less inflammatory. It has been a fascinating experience to see people explicitly discuss these issues, in part because of a re-experience or the beginning of a new experience of nuclear fear that I don't think has been present since the Cold War. Mm-hmm. I would argue that we are at this point probably closer to nuclear use than we have been since the end of the Cold War. Over the last year, it's also become really obvious that a large number of Americans believe that the U.S. nuclear launch process is more restrained or constrained than it actually is. So in reality, the President of the United States has virtually unrestricted authority to use nuclear weapons against adversaries and enemies. Mm-hmm. If Trump said nuke Chicago, we're probably not going to nuke Chicago. If Trump says, I want a well done on North Korea, we're going to nuke Korea, or at least North Korea, and maybe China too. So that's been really fascinating to see play out. And there have also been a whole series of events that have not helped with stability. So the United Nations speech that Trump gave was really unusual for the United Nations. It was bellicose. The North Koreans saw it as offering evidence in support of their beliefs about U.S. hostility and their need for nuclear weapons. The Trump button tweet was an especially exciting moment in this brave new world.
And I'll read that tweet just in case the listeners didn't hear about it. @RealDonaldTrump said, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated that the, quote, nuclear button is on his desk at all times. Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I, too, have a nuclear button, but it is a much bigger and more powerful one than his, and my button works.
Paging gender theory. Trump has done a really good job of making the case for the importance of the sort of research that I and that others do with looking at gendered ideologies playing out in international relations, right? He has a very what seems kind of simplistic understanding of force and military force and its power in the world. I would argue that recently the Hawaii false alert of incoming ballistic missile attack caused or resulted in the degree of panic that it did because people, some people at least, are beginning to realize that nuclear war is a very real possibility. Mm-hmm. During the Cold War, when you had false alarms, my observation would be that people tend to react to the degree that they think it's plausible at that moment, right? Hawaii began testing its civil defense system again only in December, partly as a result, as I mentioned, of like the UN speech and the ongoing crisis with North Korea. So clearly, some folk are feeling pretty twitchy.
And that nuclear posture review that came out on February 2nd?
Horror show. It was pretty bad. So even if the systems that are proposed, like the low-yield submarine-launched ballistic missile or the new submarine-launched nuclear cruise missile, don't get built, potential adversaries of America, including Russia and China, will have to take into account in their own planning the increasing role and importance of U.S. nuclear weapons in foreign policy and force projection, making us all less safe and increasing the chances somebody will do something a little bit silly or that we'll have an arms race or other fun stuff.
Thanks for coming in, Marty.
Thanks for having me.
That was Marty Adam Smith and PhD candidate Marty Pfeiffer. You can find the full interview at Marty Pfeiffer's Twitter account, @NuclearAnthro. And you can find all these interviews and all our previous episodes at KUNM.org. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.